Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 25th, 2014. And this past, let's say, week and a half, I had some adventures. I'm going to be talking about those tonight. A few other comments quickly before that, but basically, here's what happened. I went on a tour, let's put it that way, and looked at some sites, some locations where potential sites to put the big wing generators. These are the 1,000 foot, potentially up to 4 gigawatt wing generators for electricity, and to observe these sites, talk to people, and get a feel for what this would be like actually being in the field. And so that's what I'm going to be reporting on tonight. But first, a few quick comments. This, and by the way, a couple of these sent in by listeners, so that's always helpful because I cannot be every place. I am many times busy with adventures or work behind the scenes, whatever's going on. And so I can't be on the internet looking for all of the details that are around out there. So thanks for sending these in. But somebody sent in a story. There's a scientist, a Mr. Tao, I believe the name was, and he's proposing building 1,000-foot high walls around the country to prevent tornadoes. And now, you know, at first thought, first of all, you have to understand how tornadoes work. His biggest critics are people from the standard meteorology community who thinks that tornadoes are made from updrafts in thunderstorms that occur naturally because of sunlight in the atmosphere. They don't even know what causes tornadoes. So you have the blind criticizing the blinder. But at any rate, they're envisioning 1,000-foot tall walls to build across entire states. And these, they say, would block tornadoes from passing. And I'm like, wow, if you understand that tornadoes are caused by electrical conditions from the ionosphere, your 1,000-foot wall is going to be meaningless. It's not going to do anything. And then, but, you know, I always play devil's advocate when I look at crazy things like this. But the first thing is, how do these things get publicity? And as I've always said, as I say in the new book, the new e-book, the McCanny Wing Generator, the only things that get funded or notoriety are the things that won't work, patently won't work. But now let's look at what these would do the 99.99999% of the time when there are not tornadoes. You have a 1,000-foot wall running across a state blocking the ground-level wind. Now, if you just happen to be next door to this or downline just a little bit from this, on a hot summer day, you're not going to get any wind. So the question is, are you going to try and stop tornadoes at the expense of blocking the wind? You know, we have situations like this now where, for example, they're putting these mammoth three-blade wind generators in people's backyards. They roll and they gnaw and they make noise and they rumble and they creak and they kill birds. The dead birds are falling in people's backyards. And the potential for these to break down is there. So they want to put a 1,000-foot wall running for hundreds of miles across Texas and Louisiana and North Dakota. Well, first of all, it ain't going to happen. Second of all, it doesn't work. Third of all, the people who are criticizing it in the media don't know what causes tornadoes. That's the National Weather Service. So this is really a three-ring circus. Just reporting on that. Okay, on comet issues, comet sighting spring is approaching Mars. That's going to be coming up here. And we now have five official spacecraft at Mars. The India spacecraft just arrived. So there's two rovers, four satellites, and then I include the mystery military satellite, or the fleet of them, that I know are at Mars and they're not reporting on. But let me just give you a summary of what's going to happen here. And unfortunately, this is going to be during the middle of the daytime, when you're not going to be able to see anything from Earth. And probably it would be a bit difficult to see anything anyway with this rather small comet. Although the coma is 19,000 miles across at this point, it would be rather difficult with amateur equipment to see anything. But at any rate, the effects that one should be able to see with this entourage of NASA spacecraft, which and one built by India to go up and just to look at this, and you can't tell me this fleet of satellites that just arrived, the MAVEN mission from NASA, the India satellite, and they all just happened to be arriving weeks before this comet arrives, and they were all hurriedly launched. They got to Mars in a matter of months. Normally these things take years. So obviously someone is interested in this comet passing Mars, October 19th. Actually the 18th at midnight is the actual crossing, but that's universal time. So at any rate, I'll be giving more details. But what one might expect if he had good equipment properly designed at the location at Mars, once the comet electrical conditions, this is the discharge of the solar capacitor of the comet, starts to interact with Mars, you're going to start to see auroras. By the time the comet approaches only 82,000 miles away, it's the comet. At first, I thought that the planet would be completely engulfed in the coma, and it appears that that will not be the case. So but remember that there is another aspect to a comet, not only the physical coma, which is the part you see, but it has an electrical shielding case around it of hydrogen that goes out probably maybe a half a million miles. And this is a circular structure, a Debye shielding that occurs around the electrically charged comet nucleus that will start to interact with Mars. So you're going to see auroras in Mars' atmosphere. Eventually, I do believe that there will be comet to Mars electrical discharges, something that the ancients talked about when Venus the comet, the protoplanet comet Venus, came by Mars and basically relieved Mars of its atmosphere and oceans. So, but Mars could receive a pollution event wherein it takes material from the comet tail, actually advancing or enlarging to some degree, probably very minor, but bringing in water and other chemicals into the realm of Mars' atmosphere. So, and then a whole host of electrical conditions that would occur. We might see Mars go comet. Mars, of course, is a planet much smaller than Earth. Earth has a diameter, just to give you a perspective here, our planet Earth has a diameter of about 8,000 miles. Mars is probably about half of that. And so the coma of comet sighting spring is about 19 to 20,000 miles across. So just the coma, this is the visible cloud-like structure. The nucleus is very small, probably under a mile or so across. But the coma is probably about 5 to 6 times the diameter of Mars, the planet, that we see up in the sky. So the comet will be considerably larger. The question is, will Mars develop a cometary atmosphere? Now, we saw this with a comet that passed last year. And, of course, I did a lot of commentary on that comet. But the question is, will Mars once again develop a coma? And so Unfortunately, we have to rely on NASA and other space agencies like India's space agency related to NASA through funding or other connections. We have to rely on them for data. And at any rate, I'll be talking about more on comet sighting spring in the future. But what is interesting this week is the Rosetta mission has the European Space Agency stumped. NASA has a sensor on the Rosetta space mission. Now, this is the one that has visited a comet. It's in orbit around the comet. And they're scratching their heads, possibly other body parts, trying to figure out why there's no water coming off the comet nucleus. The nucleus is very hot. It's as black can be. There's no water, snow, or ice to be found, and there's nothing coming off the nucleus. So what they have done, we've seen this before, when the comet, the Temple 1, when the Deep Impact mission approached comet Temple 1, the nucleus, they came up there. It was a hot, dry rock, no water to be found. They sent an impactor in to crash into the comet nucleus. And when it did, out came a big puff of dust and debris, but no water. So what did NASA do? They kind of went into hiding for a day or two, and then they came out and said, oh, well, we have ground-based measurements which show an impulse of water into the tail region at about that time, and so therefore the production rate from the impactor was da-da-da-da-da. The only problem is that acceleration in water vapor in the tail of the comet Temple 1 occurred 2 days before the impactor was sent in to collide with the nucleus. But you see how they fudge the data. And then they talk about water production due to the impact of the probe they sent into the nucleus of comet Temple 1. They talk about this as some kind of scientific fact. So at any rate, this is, and so now the European Space Agency is doing that, and they're talking about referring back to potential ground-based data to determine production, water production rates from an icy comet nucleus. So you see the fudging of data. Now, why would you send a space probe that takes 10 years to get to a comet, have the most sophisticated observational spectrometers and other type of sensors on this spacecraft to directly look at the comet nucleus nose to nose, all the hype, all the excitement, and then you say, we're going to refer back to Earth-based data to determine production rates, the water production rate from the nucleus? Well, of course it's absurd, but they have to stick with their story of the dirty snowball comet model. And they keep promising that, oh, well, soon the nucleus will start to activate as it gets closer to the sun, and then we'll start to see this water that's supposedly in the comet nucleus. It's just absurd. And, of course, the nucleus of a comet has nothing in related to water coming off of it. The other thing they're surprised to see is that there's hydrogen and oxygen in the tail of the comet because, well, oxygen and hydrogen are components of water. That's the atomic makeup, H2O, water. But they're seeing atomic hydrogen and oxygen out in the tail region, and this is what I've been saying all along, is that the hydrogen and oxygen come in, combine, that's what forms the water that's in the comet tail. If they're attracted in, they're ionized because of the heat of formation, also due to ionization in the light of the sun. But those ions are attracted into the comet nucleus by powerful electrical forces, and that to understand how that dynamics of the plasma discharge comet model works, you have to read my books. But anyway, that oxygen and hydrogen come in, combine, and then some of them are neutralized as they come and they see that electron cloud that's hovering around the comet nucleus. They're neutralized, and then they go floating out in the solar wind as what are known as neutrals, neutralized water molecules. And the scientists have had satellites back there. They've measured those, and they think that that's water production from the nucleus. That's how it's interpreted. But the reality is, now that you have a space probe, the Rosetta probe, which is one of, it's about the sixth one to be at a comet nucleus, nobody has ever seen any water production at the nucleus. And they're scratching, like I say, all kinds of body parts, trying to figure out what's going on here. It doesn't fit the dirty snowball comet model. Well, gee, what a surprise. Anyway, I just can't get over this. And by the way, this isn't going to end. These people are locked in their positions. They can't change their story. They're singing the same old tune, and they're going to whistle it until they all go to the grave or collect their pensions. At any rate, there's another story that's floating around, and I should comment on this because many people have asked me about it. Supposedly, there's an asteroid out there that defies gravity. That's the headline. The headline is that it is defying gravity. And, of course, another bogus story. Here's the situation. There's an asteroid that's spinning extremely fast. Now, the standard story for how asteroids form is that they were components of planets that never formed into a big planet during the alleged formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. And so they are believed to be loose composite structures of dust and little particles, etc. And so if it spins very fast, the gravity, the self-gravity of the asteroid is not enough to keep it held together. So now they're claiming, oh, van der Waals forces. Now this sounds like a mysterious term, and they can throw that around to the public and maybe fool some people. But a van der Waal force is a slight electrical force due to the way the electron charge sits in the molecules in the structure. And it's not something that you're going to encounter in free space, because if there are unbalanced charges, they're going to be neutralized very quickly. So for a long-term, self-contained van der Waals force situation to hold an object together is ludicrous. It's absolutely absurd. But they got some grad student to put his name on it, and everybody's happy because it solves their problem. But here's the reality. The asteroid is a solid rock. It can spin really fast and not come flying apart. The asteroids are chunks of planets and other objects that were blown apart when Planet X-type objects came in and did their dirty work. When these planets get ripped apart and ripped to shreds, down deep, that rock that comes out of there, and we see this in the asteroids and the meteorites that come in and they blaze into Earth's atmosphere, and you pick them up and you look at them, they're solid. They got metal in them. They are a very bound together structures, more so than granite. And so to have these things forming in outer space by planetary collisions, and then these rocks are out there, very distorted shapes, of course, and they can spin as fast as they want, and they're not going to come apart, and it doesn't defy gravity, because gravity is not the force that's holding them together. They're solid rock, very solid rock. So, once again, Tier 2 fairy tale science rules the roost out there. It just is incredible. But I'll be talking more about the Rosetta mission. They're actually going to go in November, send a probe down, and try and land on the comet nucleus and dig into it to see if they can find that water. And now they're talking about having to send another probe, because they don't expect this probe to get through that black, tarry, hot surface deep enough to get to the alleged water. Oh, yeah. Tier 2 science, isn't it lovely? Okay, well, with that said, just a couple quick reminders. I still do have sale prices on the major items on my webpage. And we had some price adjustments recently. Some of the prices went up a bit, and I was forced to do that because my prices increased. My the price that I get my water filter products, etc., has increased. And I couldn't hold back any longer. I had to increase the prices, but then I cut back and I said, I got to give people a break so they can get these products. So there are some 10% sale items still. These are the big items, like the water filter elements, the shortwave offer number 2 and 1, which are the stainless steel, the really high-end, high-quality water filters, name-branded. And then also there's with the new book, the e-book, the Mecani Wing Generator, $49.95. You can get that book for free if you buy the right combination of water filter products or any other combination of products. Okay, so enough for advertisement type talk. And by the way, this show is brought to you commercial free because people buy things on the web page, and that helps support this show. And if I never made a dime off the sale of anything, I would still have this show. It's my way of contacting the public. But I want to thank everybody who in the past have purchased items. I don't take donations, never did, never will. But thank you, everybody out there who's over the months and years and decades, really, have made your purchases to support this show. And I know there's people out there that really don't have a lot of money, and they're still making that effort. But also remember that you're getting top-of-the-line products that could save your life. And I know people appreciate when they open up that box, that stainless steel water filter, that plastic or the travel water filters, they know that what's in that box someday could very well save their life and their family's lives. So it's not just any product down the street. It's very specific. Or, for example, the Recalendar Sunstar clock. There's nothing like that on the planet. You will not find a Recalendar Sunstar clock anyplace else from Jupiter to the other side of the sun, except on my webpage. So at any rate, like I say, enough chatter about that. But go visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. This past week, actually about 10 days, in fact, tonight I'm pretty tired. It may not sound like it, but I'm always pumped up and happy when I'm doing this show. It just really gives me a lot of energy talking, and I know the public is out there growing every week and listening. But this last 10 days, I went out on a tour of the wonderful United States and saw some of the amazing sights, talked to some of the amazing people, and the point of this little adventure was to locate places that were appropriate for the big. These are the 1,000-foot-tall wing generators capable of generating up to 4 gigawatts of power each that someday we're going to be bringing online, shutting down nuclear power plants, shutting down coal plants, driving electric cars with free wind power, the way it should be done, not these stupid 3-blade generators you see sprinkled around the countryside. And I did see some of those. I was out in California. These big fields of these wind generators, and you stop and, you know, what I do too is I talk to the people and I said, well, look at those wind generators over there. You must be very happy that you have green energy here. And they just start reeling. They said, those things don't work. They don't provide any power at all. They have to shut them down when the wind blows because they don't work. That's what the public sees. That's the public's view of wind generation for electric power. But at any rate, then I tell them, you know, I've developed a system that really will produce power, large amounts of power. And then I talk to them about the wind conditions. Like this one lady, I stopped at her little grocery store, and I'm talking to her. And I said, you know, what's the wind like here? She said, it just blows like this all the time. You were talking about not too much of an elevation, so it's at near sea level, which is important because the density of air, is a big factor in the generation of electricity from wind with the wing generators. So you want to be near sea level as much as possible. You want to be in a place where you get steady, strong wind every day and night of the year. And it was. These people live in houses where they have to have the doors and hinges extra strong, and they have ropes on the doors so the door doesn't go flying off when they open the door. That's how windy it is in these areas. And that is day and night, 30, 365 days a year, 24/7, 365. And then this is the one thing I wanted to get to. All of you out there have seen the Golden Gate Bridge. And I went to visit that this past week. It's not the first time I've seen it. I've been there before. Back in the 70s, I was there. Beautiful, beautiful structure built in around 1910. Still standing, withstood major earthquakes, still standing. But now go online or get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. There's two massive tower structures near the ends of this bridge. Those towers support the cable and structure and then the bridge gridwork on which all the cement is built, of course, and then the cars drive on that. But these tower structures at the end are 625 feet tall. This is the Golden Gate Bridge, San Francisco, California, USA. 623 feet. Now that's from the water line, that's from the sea level, the water line, up to the top of the towers. The wing towers that I'm talking about are 1,000 feet tall. So if you could imagine two wing generators, 1,000 feet tall, sitting side by side, just on a matter of scale, compared to the Golden Gate Bridge, these new wing generators would dwarf the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge towers would be about the size of the main towers supporting the big wing generators. Now, these would be offshore. We wouldn't put them in a bay area or right there. These would be out in the ocean and would face the wind. Of course, they have to turn to face the wind, but that's done by putting them on barges, big ocean-going barges, and then when you have to maintain them, you come into shore. But they swing on an anchor, so they're always pointing correctly into the wind. Now, I just want to make sure you go online, or kids or parents, whoever, go online, pull up the Golden Gate Bridge, look at the profile, and understand that putting side by side two of these 1,000-foot wing generators, the twin towers of the Golden Gate Bridge, would be about the size of the base. That'd be about halfway up these 1,000-foot tall wing generators. Now, also, they're going to be about 200 feet thick. The wings are going to have a span, a width of around 200 feet. And there's going to be probably about 500 to 600 of them that are wings that are catching the energy from the wind very efficiently, not slowing it down, and driving the central generator pack, which would be the equivalent of what is sitting down under the Hoover Dam, around 4 gigawatts of electrical generation capacity. It was interesting while I was there to watch the sailboats, some of them fairly large, sailing under the bridge or sailing around in San Francisco Bay, a wonderful, wonderful sailing community out there with a very rich tradition. But to see even the big sailboats out there with their 100-foot masts, these sailboats, of course, are moved by the wind. And now compare that 100-foot-tall mast with the Marconi rig on it, triangular rig, standard rig. Does not even hold a candle to even one fraction of one of the wings that is on this 1,000-foot-tall wing generator. These are powerful units. They're big. They're going to power our country, produce electricity, and all of this Mickey Mouse horseplay that's going on in the Mideast over energy, that's what it's all about over there, is to come to an end. You got people in Washington that, by the way, this whole thing, I'll just make a quick off-the-cuff comment here about this Islamic State stuff. If you just look at the political horseplay that's going on, what's Obama saying? He's going in and he's bombing targets. Well, they funded that whole group. That's a CIA operation from the get-go. CIA is the police force of the World Bank. And what they're doing is they want all of this conflict, and then Obama comes up and he says, the only solution, we need a new government. We need a government that replaces the current government in Syria, in Iraq, in all of these countries need a new government. Well, gee, isn't that swell? Who's going to be in charge of putting that in place? When you hear the people, like in the UN talking, that live there, they're going, where did this ISIS group come from? Who's supporting them? Where did the money come from? You know, who got these people going? And they all know, without saying it, that it's the CIA, and they're causing it. And then little Obama comes in and solves the, you know, to save the day. They all know that dog and pony show. They're all tuned to it, but a lot of them can't say it, but in at least in public. And so they're using political rhetoric to try and bounce around that issue and say, we got to find out where this group came from in the first place. Well, you know, pull back the sheets and find out what's going on. It's the CIA in their causing trouble, just like they do every place else in the world. Okay, but the end point is that the issue with energy is, this is all about oil. This is all about energy, control of energy, and the control of the world through energy. The wing generator is designed not only to generate electricity, but to break the monopoly, the consortium of power that is wielded also by the same people that are looking to control water, the World Bank out of Europe, the central controlled bank that has their fingers in everything. And so little Obama is just middle management. Remember that. He's not president of anything. He's just getting better at making speeches and sounding tough. But as far as running anything, he's just reading the cue lines off a monitor. Okay, well, anyway, sorry for that little diversion there, but unfortunately you're not going to hear that on the Schmooze News Evening News. Okay, back to my little tour, and I just want to interject something here, just crossed my mind. On a flight across the country, I happened to pass right over the Flagstaff, Arizona, in Winslow, Arizona, that crater that's out there. Now, I've been on the ground at the Winslow, Arizona crater, where a meteor hit the ground and blew a hole in the ground. I forget. I think it's about a mile wide, mile hole in the ground. But I've never flown over it before. So this was kind of an interesting experience. So you can imagine my eyes are glued on it, looking down out of the airplane over the hole in the ground that was caused by a meteorite strike. And when you're at the site, you just assume that it's a big circle. It's really, you know, it's not obvious, but from the air, it looks like a square. It's almost square in shape. So very interesting. It's just a little aside note. And by the way, that'd be another good area, that windswept area out by Winslow, Arizona, for one of the wing towers out in the middle of nowhere. I have kind of a humorous story. I'm just going to recount this. This happened many years ago because I had been many times in my life I had passed on the ground down through that area, Flagstaff, going west to California or Las Vegas or something like that. And so a number of times I had passed by, it was in the middle of the night or something to that effect, or one time it was in the middle of winter and the road was blocked off. So one time I'm driving down through, making plans to drive through Arizona, northern Arizona, and I'm going to go right by the crater, and I'm planning it. Now I'm going to be there during the daylight hours, and I have it all planned. And so I'm driving down the road, and there's the sign, you know, crater, or whatever the sign says there. And you come in, there's like a little farmhouse there. You got to pay to get in. So anyway, I go driving in, and I'm driving down the long road, the long approach road. I'm driving along this road, and this is out in the middle of nowhere in northern Arizona. And it's just desolate. It's just rock. There's nothing there. Just this one little two-lane road winding through the middle of nowhere. Nothing around for 100 miles. And I'm driving out there, and I'm happy, and I'm finally going to get to see the crater at Winslow, Arizona. And so I'm driving out there, and out of the middle of nowhere comes a person dressed in a Federal Forestry Department of Agriculture uniform, waving me down like this, with the arms up in the air, waving me down and saying, "Stop! You can't go in. We've just closed the facility." I'm like, where did this person come from? Did somebody parachute him in? Like, there's nothing here. What's this guy doing out in the middle of this vast expanse of nothing? And I'm the only car in sight. It's not like there are hordes of people coming in on this road. I'm the only car there. And this guy is out there waving me down. "You can't go in. It's closed down." I'm like, wow. I make all these plans to come and see the crater at Winslow, Arizona. And now this guy comes out of the middle of nowhere, flags me down, and tells me I can't go in. So anyway, I did not get to go see it. So I'm like, oh, this can't even be happening. Anyway, finally, on another trip, I planned it again and got to see it. I was on a road trip. Actually, I was going on my way to Laughlin, Nevada to give a talk at the 2002 the 2002 UFO Congress held in Laughlin, Nevada. But I was one of the invited speakers, keynote speakers at that event. And by the way, that you can see the video of me talking there on my video set, the DVDs that are on the webpage. Okay, well, anyway, that's a little side note. But that crater from the air looks square, not round. And so that's just very curious how something could come flying in there, blow a hole in the ground that's square. Okay, anyway, back to wing generation. Now, remember that when I talk about the generation of electricity from wind power, I rarely use the term wind, simply because of the black eye that has been given to that whole industry intentionally from companies like General Electric and Siemens and others who have profited greatly through government subsidies, putting these three-blade wind generation systems out there that don't work. And many other companies, too, many other smaller companies out there who've raked in the money over the years through government subsidies and for systems that simply don't work. So I had to make a decision. I had to be creative, and I said, what am I going to call this? So I call my system the wing generator, because it's literally made up of wings. They can be sails, they can be solid wings. There's many variations on the design, and there's many variations on how they work, how they self-manage themselves in the design, whether it's small or large or medium-sized. But so the wing generator, that's the term that I've chosen, the Makani wing generator, to typify something that's totally radically new. And the whole issue of wind generation from those three-blade wind generators that simply don't work They don't produce anything. They'll never pay back. The only way they can become profitable is through government subsidies. And I just want to take another little side note here. I get to see the people who are ordering and reading this book. Now, it's not like my other books. This book is a book about serious design work, and people who understand this, this book is going all over the world. I couldn't believe the initial order. So word spread fast throughout that energy industry that somebody has come up with something, and better take note. You better take notice. And the people I know, they're listening to this show, and you should see the laundry list of people who have ordered this book. These are people from industries around the world. I would say this book is in every country in the free world at this time. It's everything from Africa to Europe to Northern Europe to the United States, of course, a lot in Canada, South America, Australia, and New Zealand, just to name a few. But yeah, this book has gone a lot of places very quickly. And I know it's raising some eyebrows across the board. And it literally can and will. It will someday replace nuclear power. It'll replace coal, natural gas, and oil as the forms of energy used to power our society and industries. And then once you do that, you realize, hey, you know, a lot of this energy that's being produced is useless. It's non-productive. Having everybody drive back and forth to a job every day that probably is pretty useless job doesn't make sense. It's not the way to run a society. You have to understand too that using natural resources to make money and to gain control and force this economic concept on the public is part of the whole monopoly game. If you all of a sudden can produce electricity for a fraction of the cost, people can drive around automobiles that last 50 to 100 years. The only reason you buy a new one is to get a little different design. But the electric motor, the batteries, everything like that is going to last you 20 years. There's no oil change. There's no grease plugs. There's, you know, there's no water cooling system. There's no carburetor. You don't have the, you know, you don't have the pollution. You're just changing wind energy into electric energy, which goes to power your automobile. All of a sudden, there's no financial gain in that. Who's going to make money off of that? Although I guarantee you somebody's going to try and do that. Okay, another little topic. Now, this is drawing off of the new ebook, McCanny Wing Generator, World Energy Project. And the issue, the baseline issue, the criteria that one has to use on any what you might call alternative energy project, something that's going to allegedly replace oil and coal and nuclear, the criteria is, can it in fact do that within a reasonable economic model? Can it do that without government subsidies? Can it do that through private industry? Can it do it in the long term and actually replace these? A lot of the problems with alternative energy is they only produce energy part of the time, and that would be true of any wind source also. But if you distribute it, now you have to combine this with the concept of distributed energy, and you overbuild. Now, how do I know this works? Because I do this myself. I live by this kind of a system, have for a while, and I understand the complexities and the simplicity all at the same time. Now, if you have controllers that are distributed, the variation in voltage doesn't matter. These concepts have been around for 20 to 30 years. It used to be that if your battery, for example, went low and started to drop in voltage because it couldn't supply the power necessary, then the device that you were running got dimmer and dimmer and dimmer until the battery finally faded away and lost all of its power. But in the modern world, with voltage controllers, you convert the electrical power, even though the battery is still, or your source of voltage, whether it's wing generation or whatever it is, even though there's variability in the voltage level and the power output, you still are pushing the same amount of power out to the end user. And the way you do this with distributed energy is very simple. If the wind doesn't happen to blow in offshore Los Angeles today, it's going to be blowing offshore in New York or Florida, Miami, off the North Carolina coast, off of San Francisco, off of Washington State or Oregon. So the end result is that if the energy sources are distributed and the control is put at the local level, distributed energy will work. There again, how do I know this works? Because I am personally using systems like this myself. And it's, you know, you learn to live with the designs that are available. I mean, this is equipment that the designs exist. There's nothing that has to be invented. You don't have to have a smart grid. The existing grid structure works just fine. So at any rate, I'm going to change gears here just a little bit. Something that I have failed to do on the past shows, the water filter elements right now that I'm selling on the webpage, I want to just reiterate the qualities that these have. Used to be, in times past, and with basically all the other manufacturers, that if you wanted to reduce fluorinated water and arsenic, you had to buy an add-on filter. And some people still use this technique. I use it myself. It works quite well, and depending on the situation, where you know that depending on your location, fluorinated water is what you're dealing with. But in many of the communities today, in Florida, in California, in Washington State, in some of the locations, Portland, Oregon, in many of the municipalities, you have a situation where you have chlorine, chloramine, volatile organic chemicals, lead, mercury, asbestos, arsenic, and fluoride. And the new, what I call GF water filter elements, take all of these out internally in the water filter itself, in the filter element. You do not need an add-on. And so, like I say, depending on where I am and what the conditions are, I'll use an add-on filter and use the old-style ceramic filters, the 7-inch candles, and use an add-on filter. That works perfectly fine in some cases. But for the average person that is in a city, or a lot of municipality water supplies, like I say, so I'm going to go through the laundry list of what these GF filters take out, and you can find these on the webpage. This list is actually taken off of the sales page. The properties of the new GF filter elements. Pathogen bacteria, 99.9999%. These are all tested in laboratory conditions. Cholera, typhoid, salmonella, E. coli, fecal coliform takes out 100%, cysts 100%, Cryptosporidium parvum, Giardia lambia, sediment 100% absolute down to 0.5 microns, that's tested at IBR laboratories. Chloramines 99%, chlorine 99%, lead 99%, fluoride 97%, volatile organic chemicals and compounds 98%, aluminum, iron, mercury, nickel, and zinc 98%, The arsenic in MTBEs, which are current in many water supplies now, 97%. Glyphosate, 99.9%. Pharmaceutical compounds, acetaminophens, progesterone, removes them, ibuprofen, naproxen, sodium, 95%. Herbicides, 99%. Nitrates, 92%. Now, this is all in your water these days. This is absolutely insane. But people are drinking water that contains, you know, pharmaceuticals. That, you know, these filter elements take those out in the filter element without any add-ons. So, once again, I call these the GF filters. They're a bit more pricey. But when I travel, as I just did, believe me, I have these with me. I just had another experience over my last 10 days of travel. I was in a hotel, taking a shower, and I got done, and my feet were burning. That's the chloramines. That's, you know, and but to drink this, you know, one thing is to take a shower with it. Well, that doesn't exactly make me feel good to find out afterwards that the city water supply was heavy with chloramines, but to be drinking that, so you better believe that I was using my travel water filter and getting all of that out of there. That's one thing also I'm very happy with, those travel water filters, the 1 liter and the 2 liter sizes, very effective. They come with extra containers, the clamp on tops, so that you can have water safely guarded in your room or in your travel location for camping. Like I said before, I was when I was down in Florida this past winter, I had my standard. I was doing the some analysis of the chemical chemtrail spraying that was going on there, and I had my full size stainless steel name branded water filter there. With the 7-inch GF filters, I gave that away to a poor family, and ended up using my 2-liter water filter. And then at another time, I gave that away, and I was using the 1-liter water filter in the kitchen for primary water filtration use, and they performed perfectly. I had plenty of water for kitchen use, for washing vegetables, for cooking, for tea, for making drinks, drinking water on a daily basis. Of course, you just have to fill it up on a little more regular basis. But the small water filters working very well in the field. But once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on any of the links to the sales page, and you can determine, you can pull up this list of it's called the filter element spec sheet. You'll find it in the middle column of the table. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, well, I needed to include that. It's something that it's escaped. I've just forgotten about it over the past weeks, but to read off the list of, just whatever's in your water. And it's unbelievable what's in the water tables these days, especially the pharmaceuticals. The ability to get the pharmaceuticals out of there, the chloramines, the chlorides, and the, you know, all of that other stuff. I mean, it's the laundry list of what's in water today is just unbelievable. And really for healthy, just you're drinking that on a daily basis, my goodness, it's, you know, you have to get that out of your water. But the new GF filters are the ticket. They cost a little bit more, but then you don't have to have the add-on filters. Okay, enough said. Back to the wing generator issue. I've got a couple of minutes left here. Like I said, this past week, traveling around to locations where these could be placed, my estimate is that we could build about 300 of these around the United States that would completely power all of our needs, that would be more than a one-to-one replacement for nuclear power generators, because remember now, we're going to start to power fleets of automobiles with electricity. And so that's a whole additional level of energy usage based on electricity, something that has not been done before. I heard people commenting about the popularity of electric cars in Florida, and not so much in California yet, but I think this is coming along. It's something that we're going to see on a large scale with the new manufacturing plant for electric cars. Once Musk starts this in Nevada, and that's another place I happen to visit is Nevada, a place with abundant locations for wind generation power distribution, and also, like I say, with the new manufacturing plant for electric automobiles going in there, many other companies are going to be putting more emphasis on electric automobiles. The so-called Detroit companies are going to be basically, they either have to change and compete with that, with pure electric automobiles, or they're going to be out of business. People are just not going to buy gasoline anymore. If you have the alternative of buying an electric car for less than what you'd buy a gasoline car, you have the proper charging stations around the country, there's no maintenance at all, and you know you're getting your power from in the future from clean wind generation power, there's just no question as which is more economical. You just subtract out just the maintenance issue alone, and you are off and running in an economic zone, which unheard of with gasoline engines. So these days are coming. It's going to happen. The people that resist are going to be like the people that remained with the IBM mainframes and didn't see distributed computing company coming. They're going to be like the Kodak film company that didn't see digital photography coming. Or, you know, the blacksmith that was still depending on making horseshoes for horses in an epoch where the automobile was coming. And by the way, it was a pleasure to see the old cable car system in San Francisco still operating, built who knows how long ago, well over 100 years ago, still operating on electricity. Very interesting. So I'm about out of time for this week, but remember the webpage, your purchases support this show and my ongoing work. And I greatly appreciate it. The other issue is that many people are responding to the licensing of the new wing generation. This is really taken off. This is going to go places. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.